Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming Outlander series or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 25 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So, announcements this week. For anyone who is thinking about why I sound different than I normally do, I am being Skyped in because my daughter and I are on a brief vacation. We're on a holiday across the United States, so we will be back in studio, if you will, in 2 weeks. So until then, enjoy my dulcet tones via Skype.
We worked really hard to get the content so that she could skedaddle, and she is phoning in for the announcements. Okay, go ahead.
So, announcements this week. So, good news for our Aussie friends. Australia has announced that they will, the entire country apparently, has announced that they will be getting Outlander via the Soho channel. So, that's great news. I know a lot of our Aussie fans have been clamoring to find out whether or not they would, in fact, get to watch the Outlander series with us as it airs. So that's good news for the Aussies, as well as Diana posted a very long Facebook post, I might add, regarding the international sale of TV shows. So if you have more, if you want some more information about the behind-the-scenes stuff that goes into it and maybe more information about that, please go visit her site. There's some really good information there. Diana posted some photos of herself and Sam and her daughter, who's adorable, by the way. And Sam is, like, in his full, like, Highlander regalia with, like, the little puffy shirt and his plaid and a really nice jacket and looking delicious as always. I think she referred to him as a planetoid. Am I wrong?
Correct.
Planetoid.
Whatever. In jest, of course, as to people who think he's just not big enough.
I know, but whenever...
or tall enough.
Whenever I see the word planetoid, I always think of the movie So I Married an Axe Murderer, and which is funny because he actually says it with a Scottish accent, but Mike Myers' character, when he's playing the father, they have a son who has a very large head, and he spends a good portion of the film comparing his head to other large items. Like, he calls it an orange on a toothpick, and it has its own weather system, and you know, I bet he's going to cry himself to sleep on this gigantic pillow. But one of the
I do remember that.
He says is it's a virtual planetoid. So every time I see the word planetoid,
I love Mike Myers.
So I Married an Axe Murderer. So I thought that was kind of funny.
Oh, our 90s childhood.
Completely.
Wayne's World.
Exactly. Swing. So, and there was also a Ron Moore interview with The Hollywood Reporter. I think the biggest thing I took away from this was the continued comparisons to, like, Game of Thrones. Like, they're calling it the Game of Thrones for women or the Game of Thrones for Scotland, which, to a degree, I completely agree. They are two of the same, not genres, but two big, giant book series that have been turned into television series. So I think that's the only thing that I would call them similar in, personally. Other than that, like, story content-wise, I wouldn't think they were similar at all. What do you think?
I agree. They're completely different. I understand, as you said, one is, they're both fiction, but one is historical fiction, the other one is maybe, it's an or alternate historical fiction. Basically, the one thing that I will quote Ron Moore on the subject of Outlander being referred to as the Game of Thrones for women, would he agree? And this is something that I think all fans can agree with, and this is a quote of Ron Moore from the article. "The only thing that I take from Game," meaning Game of Thrones, "is that the adaptation of a successful book with an existing fan base can not only work, it can be wildly successful. So it gives me great confidence and hope that we can do that."
Agreed.
To me, that is spot on and hits the nail on the head.
The only thing that I would say is, as a woman who watches Game of Thrones, I find that phrasing to be a little bit sexist.
Oh, that's true.
Because I enjoy Game of Thrones.
Did you say sexist or offensive? I didn't hear you.
I said sexist, but offensive works
sexist
as well.
I guess you could say, you know, well, I can't tell you what to say. You could say sexist. Maybe that's true in a sense. I don't take that as sexist. I take that as someone maybe with a slightly, maybe sexist means someone has a closed mind, so maybe they're synonymous. But I could almost understand Game of Thrones for Scotland.
Agreed.
I could almost see that more.
I would have no offensive thoughts or anything negative to say about that phrasing, because I would think that was true, because it is sort of a Game of Thrones kind of scope of series, only taking place in historical Scotland, as opposed to Game of Thrones for women, which implies that men won't enjoy it, and I think that they absolutely will.
Well, it actually, and I was looking at it the other way. You took it as only women would enjoy Outlander, and I took it as only men enjoy Game of Thrones. Last time I checked, I'm a woman, and I have liked Game of Thrones.
Last time you checked, was this an ongoing issue for you?
No, I'm just saying, it's pretty obvious, at least to me, that I have never been anything but a woman, and I do not plan to change that. But I don't plan on that having changing, that's what I'm saying. And so I don't take offense. I just find it kind of funny that, what, Game of Thrones, does that mean that if there's a Game of Thrones for women, then the original Game of Thrones is not for women? I don't know, because I've watched it. And yes, of course, there's sex and violence and, oh, gosh, like that whole Red Wedding, blurg. I mean, there's a lot of shock and wonderful stuff in it, but I don't take it as a show for men.
No.
Maybe I'm just too forward-thinking and I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. I just mean, seriously, maybe we are not typical. I don't know. I don't take offense. I just find that kind of laughable.
Look at the costuming alone. The costuming alone to me says there's women watching.
Oh, because
like
of the
detail they put into those costumes and those dresses. If this was really a show for men, they would just have the women walking around naked the whole time. Let's be honest.
Like pretty much do.
Nah. The only time they ever have them just walking around naked is when they're in the brothel. That's it. Other than that, everyone's pretty much, you know, clothed most of the time. Anyway, that's getting off subject. But that's pretty much, that was the biggest thing I took away from the Ron Moore interview. The next thing that we had was our very own Teresa from Outlander Kitchen had a TV
Yay!
Spot.
Hold on, a little bit of applause. Yay, Teresa!
It was so awesome. I loved seeing that. And it was nice
to put a
face with the voice. I mean, I've seen her picture, but to see a moving video of someone that we've spoken to was kind of fun, too.
I told her that we had seen it, and I had a very, very, very brief chance to chat with her privately, just, you know, on internet chat. And, yeah, I told her, I said, it was so neat. And I had, you know, tears in my eyes. I'm not crying. Enough of that to come this summer, people. But I had tears, like, you know, glazing over my eyes. Oh, that sounds wrong. I had tears coating my eyes, I guess you could say. I was just so happy for her.
I know. I just, honestly, anything that is, any person or anyone affiliated with being a fan of Outlander or being affiliated with Outlander in general, anytime I see any of them get any kind of screen time or any kind of recognition, my heart grows like 12 times. Like, I feel like the great we've learned.
It doesn't hurt her culinary career. I'm not talking about that, though. To me, it's just so wonderful that any fan sites or groups or whatever, if they get any kind of screen time, it is more screen time for other fans and ultimately Outlander, period.
Because honestly, I want this with as much press as possible, because I want all books to be made into series so that I can get my whole series.
Absolutely.
So I consider any press and any good press good for us and good for the entire series.
Good juju.
We also got a new photo from Stars, a picture of Claire and Frank, which, of course, Ginger is in love with Tobias. Let's not anyone kid around
about
that. But
as Pod, I replied at Outlander Stars, sigh. #, Tobias Menzies. And then Stars liked it.
Of course I did.
And
you're a giant nerd.
Gosh.
If I didn't tell you to your face, if I haven't told you to your face yet, you are a giant nerd.
I can't help it. I just like him.
I know you do, but for me, I can't get the pictures of him in the revolutionary kind of like England garb out of my face, and all I can see is him as Blackjack, and I can't get past it. I just think, and that's just how I'm going to be.
I understand. And, you know, my feelings of Tobias, I do not believe will change, because he, just as an actor, period, he is brilliant. And that's actually part of being a brilliant actor, is being so believable in something that someone starts to hate you or someone starts to really dislike you.
True.
I hope I don't, well, because of his talent, I would guess that I would end up hating that character. We already dislike the character, but him bringing it to life, or someone of his level bringing it to life, I think will make it that much more repugnant. But as far as an actor, I cannot wait for the scenes between, even though there's a lot of nasty bits, I am more excited for the scenes between Blackjack Randall and Claire than almost any other scenes. Because we know we're going to have a ton of Jamie and Claire.
Yeah.
That's just the whole book. But there's not a ton of BJR and Claire. There are a good number, but there's so many fewer in comparison. So that chemistry, ooh boy.
That will definitely be something worth watching.
Man.
We also got word, and this is a big coup for us. I think it's not for us personally, but as Outlander and Sam Heughan fans, that the
for
US,
all fans, for all Outlander
yes,
fans.
Yes, the U.S. will in fact get screenings of Emulsion. Which
and
I
for those who do not know, if you follow on Twitter and maybe on Facebook, you will definitely know what Emulsion is. Suki Singh wrote and directed this film, and it was obviously released, or at least shown in the UK. It was shown, it just had its Scottish premiere, I believe, in Inverness a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big kind of event, and that was, of course, blew up Twitter as well. And we followed that to the extent that we could, given the time difference. And so many fans were there and got pictures with him and with Suki and all of that. So he's been encouraging us to contact Tug Inc. And if they had enough contacts, then they would be able to do it. And we just found out this week that it is now a reality. Now, of course, the individual locations have to apply to Tug to get, I think it's to sell at least 75 tickets for whatever location. And if they can have the pre-sales for that date and time, then they will be able to make contact with, you know, you have to contact the theater, et cetera. And then Tug basically brings everything together. And if I understood one of Suki Singh's tweets this past week, he said on a certain date, I do not remember what that date was, on a certain date, the film was going to be uploaded to the Tug servers or the Tug site. So what I get from that is, of course, we're in the digital age. This kind of thing, once the need is there or the demand is there and they agree to take it on, then it's uploaded to the server, and that is then how Tug can share it with whomever in the country. And this, from what I understand, this is only a U.S. thing. This is not for Canada. This is not for Mexico. So it doesn't affect the rest of North America. But I hope and I pray for everyone around the world who might want to see this that there are other opportunities such as Tug Inc. And I urge you to keep exploring them if you want to bring this to your country.
Absolutely. So happy belated Valentine's Day to all of our
Woohoo! Listeners. Happy V-Day.
And I'm sure none of you missed this, but I do want to point out that I was traveling on Valentine's Day towards my holiday destination. And while
I was sitting,
yes,
while I was sitting
in the airport, I happened to notice that Stars had posted a new photo. And when I opened this picture, my jaw dropped, and I kind of started looking around in the airport thinking I might need some alone time. And then I was kind of a little inappropriate looking at this picture with my five-year-old daughter sitting next to me. But I looked at this
in public.
In public, mind you, surrounded by people because it was a very full flight. But
this picture of a shirtless Sam was...
No. Let's not start off on this. A shirtless Jamie.
I'm sorry if that's what you saw.
You saw Sam and you did not see Jamie?
Oh, I saw Jamie, don't get me wrong.
Okay.
But all I could think as I was looking at this picture was I had my arm around that and he had his arm around me.
Okay, we understand.
And like as I retweeted this to people and they were retweeting it, I was like, hey, remember that time he had his arm around me? Hey, remember that time? Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, when you look at this picture, please remember that I have touched that. But he looked...
I did not tweet that as Pod.
She didn't, but I tweeted that to my friends privately as me. But he looked so good in this picture. Like, this is the best picture, I think, that they have released of Sam to date. And that eclipsed every picture that they have released so far to me, for me. Like, that was the best Jamie picture I've received. In fact, I wish that my pocket Jamie looked like that. Like a pocket Jamie like that. Stars, if you're listening, make me a pocket Jamie like that. And then... And then I noticed that Ginger, who generally, you know, gatekeeps our Outlander Pod Twitter account, had not retweeted yet.
I'm the one who's almost always signed into it. That's all.
Well, you keep my gate. That's all I'm saying. You're my gatekeeper.
Oh, okay.
You want to be the keymaster? Take a choice.
Oh, wow. No Ghostbusters. Go ahead.
Anyway, I noticed we had not retweeted it yet. Retweeted it yet. So I just kind of sent her a text, and I was like, hey, did you see the new picture posted yet? And I didn't get an answer yet. So I immediately posted after that. I was like, retweet it, biatch. And
she did not say biatch. It was just full on without the O.
This is true. But, you know, there are kids listening, maybe. I don't know. Hopefully yes. Not. Anyway, I posted that to her, and she immediately, like, shamed me by posting that I actually posted that to her on my Twitter account, which I'll accept it. I totally said it, and I'm okay with that.
But you love that. You were laughing.
I did laugh, but
I don't know if you loved it, but you were laughing, and people, I don't know if they retweeted us, but that was funny. They liked it.
And I will say that was a fantastic Valentine's Day present. Fantastic. Yes. Thank you, stars. More please.
Yes.
Just now, more.
Now, that was your reaction.
Yes.
Now to my reaction.
Ready.
We know Jamie is played by Sam. I'm not going to get into that. That's not a secret. But I only saw Jamie in this photo. But while he's never looked bad, I've never seen him look bad in anything. This is the first time, even though he's had whatever bulk he's had for the past 6 months or so, you know, since he started bulking up last summer. To me, it has not been so obvious until this shot. There are shots all over from him before, either when he was cast or before he was cast last summer. So anytime before maybe last August, I don't know. Of him being in other productions, you can find a lot of images of him, you know, shirtless, whatever, online. And he's very toned, he's very lithe, he's very fit.
He's not nearly as beefy. Not nearly as beefy as he is in this picture.
Okay, I didn't think he looked. I don't even want to use the word beefy, but I understand what you're saying. But yeah, he was very lithe and lean. Lean is the best word. Lean and toned. Now, hold on.
He looks like a man in that picture.
I don't know, and this is. I'm not going to go past the unacceptable meter here, but I'm just going to say what the truth is. I don't know if he shaved or waxed, but there was grooming going on. And now all I can say is he had you for the role, of course, because we're talking, you know, 1740s as opposed to 2014. So I understand it for the role. But and it makes me – I've wondered this. I don't know if it's – been in an episode, but I've wondered this aloud as well. I wonder if they're gonna make Katrina not shave her.
Yo,
armpits.
Don't even say it. Oh, okay, armpits. I thought you were going somewhere else.
Summer.
I was very
concerned. The other place. Okay. Wow. Tangent here. I just got done watching Black Sails, the most recent episode.
Dude, the first episode of Black Sail. Can we just talk
about
Blackbeard?
Yeah, that was on purpose to make
but
you.
But can we just
like,
talk about Blackbeard? Blackbeard.
Blackbeard. I know. But last night it was an entirely different character. But I'm like, oh my goodness! And I swear, all these may not all, but a lot of these looked fake. I mean,
you know,
fake.
Most of them are, and there's a term for them, and I can't remember what it is.
I so want to call this, like, Netherbeard.
The reason it looks fake is because they are fake. They actually, there's a term for them. They're called Merkins, and that is Merkin. You can Google it, but, you know, you might not want to.
Exactly.
If anyone says Merkin to you, just know they're talking about fake pubes.
If anybody says Merkin, walk away. So that's the little tangent, but kind of related. So I don't even want to talk about Merkins and Outlander, but I was thinking about her Oxters, nothing else. But it would make sense. So anyway, back to the picture of Jamie. I was like, oh my goodness, he's a grown-up man. Or even though he's a 23-year-old virgin, he's a grown-up man, and he looks like he's actually a man. And I still wouldn't use the word beefy, even though I just did a second time. But I understand what you're trying to say. He looked... not big, huge, nowhere near the word fat. No. But he looked so... he's definitely not lean anymore. At least in that image, it could have been the angle. But you can tell he has more meat on him. But he does not look sculpted.
Here's the
and
thing. That's what I like about it. He doesn't look like he's been working out. He looks like he's been working, like,
yes,
in the fields, like he's been active.
Yes.
He doesn't have the look of a bodybuilder. Like, he still has a neck. He doesn't look like somebody who's been sculpting their abs for like hours a day. He's been out in the fields helping bring in the harvest. Someone who's been out working with horses. He looks like someone who's been active. He does not give the appearance of somebody who's chiseling their abs. So I think he's done a really good job with whoever he's got training him, getting him to look the way he needs to look. However, I would like to say that you said he looks like he's had some manscaping, which I think, why would they bother?
No, not now. Before.
Oh, before? Okay. I was like, why would they bother manscaping?
Manscaping can be anything from getting rid of it to putting to only keeping it where you want it, correct?
Oh, I mean, I guess, you know.
Maybe I'm wrong. You guys can call in. You guys can write in and tell us how wrong I am. All I'm trying to say is before there was no chest hair that we could see. Now it's kind of peppered in there, and I say, awesome. He looks like a man.
I understand what you're saying now. Okay, we're on the same page. And lastly, this week, Diana did release some more pictures from her set visit. And did you create the collage, or was somebody else already collaged it?
Oh, no, I did.
Okay, well, you created the collage, and it looks fantastic.
I just thought it's either make a collage and put credit where credit's due, or for the images, which we would do anyway, or I could have given one link and have that be the, you know, pop up as the image and then put the other three links in the post. I did not want to add four photos or have four posts.
No.
This is fine.
I liked this. This was basically a collage of Diana with weapons, which I think most people like to see women with weapons. I think there's definitely a niche for that. But she looked fantastic. She looked like she knew what she was doing. She had several very large guns that she was posed with, and posed looking like she knew what she was doing with them, which I really appreciated. And she also had a picture of her with some sort of a sword of some kind. So she was looking pretty feisty with those weapons, I think.
I just wish we had, like, the audio commentary of that.
No.
That would have been like, oh, because she did say, or I think I did see later this afternoon after I made that she tweeted something about, I think she was talking to someone about the guns or about some guns. She may have even posted this in response to a conversation, but they were talking in general about some guns. I guess they're muskets, and she said that they were quite big, and I'm like, well, yeah, they're like taller than her.
That was that. I mean, when I think musket, I don't think that gun. Like, that gun was huge.
No, me, yeah.
When I think that musket, was a, yeah, I think, like, you know, a very short, maybe a foot long kind of weapon. If that's a musket, I've completely been misimagining muskets for my entire life, which is completely possible. I'm just saying.
Well, we're not around a lot, but this just made me think about our read along when we were talking about, I don't know. Oh, I forget. It was the one where she had was it the same chapter as she had the knife skills training?
Yes. Where they were talking about the kickback.
Yeah. And that, I thought, my gosh, well, no wonder women were not going to be.
No, I don't think that's the same kind of gun, because the gun that they were speaking of, you braced it on the opposite forearm.
Yeah,
that
this
gun she was holding, you could not brace. You literally needed both hands to hold this gun. And I think that about wraps up our announcements for this week.
I think that's a good place to stop and now introduce our interview.
Our interview, our featured guest, if you will. So without further ado, we'd like to introduce you to our guest, Dave.
We are so happy to welcome Dave here to our podcast, to our pod studio. And Dave is actually Canadian, but works for National Trust of Scotland, National Trust Scotland. And we're so happy to welcome him here. We were fortunate enough to make contact with Dave via social media, and he has written articles on Scottish castles and is extremely knowledgeable about Bannockburn. He has contributed an article about Castle Doon as well as the village of Culross to us, and we are very happy to share that with listeners or readers, and we'll be putting that in the blog post accompanying this episode. So welcome, Dave.
Hi, thanks very much for having me, Ginger and Summer. It's an absolute pleasure to be on.
And you're welcome to tell us all your last name, because we did not wish to butcher it.
It's one of those unpronounceables. Yeah, I've given up saying it. I just spell it out now for folks. It's Weinzock.
Oh, very nice. Okay, so a little German-ish sounding.
It is, yeah. Northeast German. It's a bit of a mutt name, though, you know, so that's why it throws people off.
Okay,
well,
very good.
Just a lot of consonants all back-to-back.
That's so. It, yeah. There's a C in there, you know, that's completely unnecessary.
So, Dave, tell us about, we do have specific questions, but before we get to them, we want to open up the mic, your mic, to you, and have you introduce yourself to us. Tell us as much as you can, or as much as you would like to share.
Okay, sure. Well, as you mentioned, I'm an expat Canadian who's now living in Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland. And why did I find myself here? What brings me to Scotland? I suppose that's the question. And I'm terribly ashamed to admit that it probably, at the end of the day, comes down to a viewing of Braveheart when I was about 8 or 9.
we have no shame either. It's okay.
Okay, great. Charging ahead. I saw that and I was absolutely entranced by not just the spectacle, but the history behind it as well. And I must admit to a bit of an affection for the underdogs in history. So studying history when I was in elementary school in Canada, I wasn't ever quite so interested in places like, you know, Egypt or even the Roman Mediterranean world, not necessarily because they don't have tons of fascinating things going on. They absolutely do. But I just felt like they were the road more traveled. And I was looking for something a little grittier, you could say. And so Scottish history really appealed to me in that sense, because it seems, from what I've since learned about it, that Scottish history is really told from the outside by people coming from elsewhere in a great majority of instances. And there's something about the mystery that it's shrouded in. There are hundreds of years of Scottish history where all we know are, you know, an obscure king's name here or a place name there. And that is extraordinarily appealing as a amateur historian, which I certainly am. I'm not qualified. I didn't go to school for history. I went to school for politics, international relations. But history at the end of the day is what really grabs me. And having grown up in suburban Toronto, where it was quite difficult, to say the least, to get my hands on medieval history, I was just absolutely entranced by the idea of living in a city with a castle at the center of it, which Edinburgh does have, one of the most famous castles in the world. And that really is what brought me to Scotland, was fascination for the history and the idea that it would be a very good place to live. And since arriving here, I've thrown myself in the deep end in terms of its history. I've got a bookshelf that's absolutely packed to the gills of books about all aspects of Scottish history that I'm reading at a far slower rate than I'm accumulating them, of course. That tends to be the way it goes. But I also began working with the National Trust for Scotland as a volunteer in the first place. Edinburgh has a street right at the heart of it that composed the majority of medieval Edinburgh, in fact, up until about the 1700s. It's called the Royal Mile, and it stretches for about a mile, hence the name, with Edinburgh Castle on one end down to Holyrood Palace, the official residence of the Queen in Scotland, on the other end. And it's a very picturesque, touristy kind of place. But nonetheless, I took a post as a tour of the National Trust for Scotland's buildings called Gladstone's Land. And it's nothing particularly spectacular in terms of grand history, but it's absolutely stellar in terms of everyday social history and seeing what the lives of people in medieval Scotland and early modern Scotland would have been like. So that is what set me down the road while I was studying politics to say, you know what, no, I think I'm going to do this history thing. And it so happened that in the first few weeks I arrived in Scotland back in September 2011, I went on a little bus tour all through the Highlands for 3.5 days. And that gave me a taste for it. I mean, once you go to the Highlands, it sinks its claws in deep and you don't want to leave. It's an absolutely magical place. And that trip involved a visit to a castle or two. And in fact, one of the castles that we visited, my very first in Scotland, was Doune Castle, where much of the filming for Outlander is taking place. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that will be the location for Castle Leoch. So a very important site for Outlander fans. And that kicked it off on the right foot. It's a fantastic location. And I thought, you know what, I'd really like to see more of these. And so over the last 2.5 years, I have visited 62 castles to date, all throughout Scotland. So I've got the bug, you could safely say, overcompensating perhaps for my time back in Canada, where my interest was intellectual rather than hands-on. And currently, I'm still getting out to as many castles as I can. In fact, I'm working on a book about Scottish castles, which is going to incorporate about 35 of what I consider to be the most historically rich and visually compelling and interesting to visit castles that Scotland has to offer. Scotland has, depending on how you count it, between 750 and 2,500 castles. Believe it or not, it's the most densely concentrated part of the world in terms of fortifications and castles. But my main role right now with the National Trust for Scotland, which is one of these pinch-me sorts of jobs, is out at the Bannockburn Heritage Centre. And my job title there is Battle Master, which I got told by a friend, you know, that's not a job title, that's a rank in Call of Duty. I had a hard time arguing with him over that. But
it's kind of a badass title, when you think about it.
It's pretty good. It works well at parties, I find. And Bannockburn is an absolutely pivotal moment in Scottish history. The Battle of Bannockburn was an absolutely pivotal moment in Scottish history. It was one of these points at which the fate of the country could have been made or broken. And in this particular case, it was made. So you have Robert the Bruce as King of the Scots. And this is during the Scottish Wars of Independence, fought in the year 1314. And Edward II, King of England, on the other side invading. And the Heritage Centre is brand new. It's opening in March of this year, and it's dedicated to a reinterpretation of this battle with very up-to-date history. But the great thing about it is it's quite non-traditional in that it is a very hands-on experience. It's learning through doing. And so my role is as battle master there, as I mentioned, and that involves standing at a battle table, which has a projection of the battlefield as it would have appeared 700 years ago, with Stirling Castle up on a big rock, and actually little divisions of men marching on to this table. Very much, you could think of it like a video game, and visitors are able to command their own units in this battle and fight their own Battle of Bannockburn, and it's my job to guide them through their interpretation of the battle, and then once they've wrapped up their version of it, I then tell them what actually happened in the historical battle itself. So it's one of these things that I count myself as being very fortunate to be able to take part in, and to be able to interact with the people there who are all incredibly knowledgeable and very passionate about what they do. And certainly the 8 or 9 year old me, who, you know, saw Braveheart and wanted to get involved in Scottish history, couldn't imagine a better way to do it. I'm also involved with the National Trust for Scotland as a project manager. They're looking to branch out and really engage with the student community in Scotland. And so I'm in charge of getting student groups established at universities throughout Scotland. And we just, in fact, launched a student group at the University of Edinburgh. The launch event had over 100 people attending, and it was all centered around the Battle of Bannockburn. It's the 700th anniversary of the Battle of Bannockburn this year, on June 23rd and 24th, over the 2 days that the battle was fought. So it's an incredibly exciting time in Scotland right now. Not only are there several anniversaries like Bannockburn, it's the 225th anniversary of the Battle of Killiecrankie, which was a battle in the first Jacobite revolt of 1688-1689. But also, of course, there's the vote for Scottish independence. So it's an absolutely fascinating time to be in the country, and I count myself very fortunate as a non-native Scot to have really been welcomed into Scotland. And that's one thing that Diana Gwelden, you know, absolutely hits the nail on the head, is that Not just Highland, but Scottish hospitality is pretty unmatched, in my opinion. So very exciting time, and very good to be here. So settled right in, you could say.
Wow, that's just so much that you've shared. There is so much I know I want to ask about, but one of the things is that some are, like, kind of joke, and I know people online joke in a very positive way, that 2014 is just this year. We joke about it as being the year of Outlander, but it truly is the year of Scotland. Is this not Homecoming Scotland year?
It is, yes. Yeah. So Homecoming will be happening as well. I mean, one of the really great things about living in Scotland is you get to go along to Highland Games and all that great stuff. And in fact, that was a part of life living back in Nova Scotia and Canada as well. There are more Scots Gaelic speakers in Nova Scotia than there are in Scotland itself, and that's a result of the diaspora that occurred after the Highland clearances. But the Homecoming is an absolutely massive event, and certainly a lot of the dispersed clans from all over the globe will be gathering at Bannockburn, in fact, as a major focal point for the Homecoming. So that's incredibly exciting to have people from all over the world who have an affection for Scotland and a genealogical tie to it as well, to be coming and discovering everything that it has to offer. One of the absolute pleasures of working on this book that I'm doing is getting to go around to different castles which have clan associations. nations, and even being able to talk to the heads of clans, for instance, who are often more than happy to share their history. They're very proud of it. And castles that are world famous, ones like Duart Castle on the Isle of Mull, or Ilundonan Castle up near the Isle of Skye, they were actually rebuilt during the 20th century by very enthusiastic clan heads who wanted to reestablish the clan presence in Scotland and get in touch with that history. The early 20th century saw a real revival in all things Gaelic, and so you had lots of people studying Scottish history and wider Gaelic history, and lots of clans really coming back to their roots. And the homecoming is an extension of that. And, you know, there are thousands upon thousands of people who will be visiting Scotland to get back in touch with their roots, which is just a tremendous thing. I think there are very few places in the world that hold that kind of sway over people, even after they've left, in some cases, centuries ago in familial terms. So absolutely lots going on. Couldn't be a more exciting time to be in Scotland or to be visiting Scotland. As that happens, I mean, historic locations in Scotland have actually had record visitor numbers in 2013, and that's looking to just increase in 2014 as well. So absolutely recommend coming along. If you have any clan connections or not, you'll be made more than welcome. I can assure you of that.
Could you say briefly what exactly Homecoming Scotland is, and who hosts it, who puts it on, etc.?
What it is a way for people with Scottish ancestry to get back in touch with their history. So thousands of people come and visit Scotland, and there are gatherings in cities all throughout the country of folks going and doing ceilidhs, which are these fantastic, very lively Scottish dances, and there are massive feasts. And so I don't know a whole lot about the homecoming. In fact, I've been so wrapped up in sort of the other aspects of it. But I do know that it's an incredibly important event in terms of people's identity. And so there's going to be lots of revelry, lots of you know, visitations to historic sites and dancing and drinking, of course. I mean, that goes without saying. So something to really look forward to. And that happens over the summer. I believe the bulk of the homecoming is in July and August.
That makes sense. As yourself, I have not read a lot of detail about it, but I have seen it publicized many times, especially on the websites and on Facebook and on emails I get from Visit Scotland. It's a huge thing that they are pushing.
Mm-hmm.
They have been for more than a year.
Oh yeah, it's tremendous. I mean, in terms of bringing people into Scotland, it's a fantastic opportunity. And I know there's lots of preparations on the ground going on for it. I can see that at some of the castles that I visit, for instance, many of which, as I mentioned, are, you know, clan seats. And I can see that at Bannockburn as well, even though we've not been told a terrible amount about it. I know that there are special preparations being put in place to handle the multitude of people who are going to be visiting. So should be good fun.
Now, you mentioned you began as a volunteer for National Trust for Scotland. How did that turn into a job? Although your job obviously is quite specific because of your knowledge. Are you at liberty to discuss that?
Oh, absolutely.
Was it something that you were offered, or that you you applied for, that you had that you competed for, et cetera?
Yeah, well, volunteering is something that I would recommend to anybody who's looking to get a foot in the door, no matter what their area of expertise or desired expertise is, really. So started as quite a humble room guide in a 16th century tenement building, which is essentially an apartment building. It's a living building where people, you know, would have made their lives. And it's quite a fantastic location, Gladstone's Land, because unlike a lot of places, you have people from different levels of society living, all intermingled in this one building. So as a room guide, we would take a particular spot in the property. Guests would come in, and we would do our best to explain what life would have been like in that particular environment through the late 16th up until late 18th centuries. It's a property that does encompass quite a few different periods of time, which is great because there's lots and lots to talk about. And it has connections with some really important moments in Scottish history, things like the failed Darien scheme, which launched Scotland into an absolutely disastrous state of poverty right before the Union of the Scots and English Parliaments went ahead. And so historians look at that as a major factor behind why perhaps there was so much support for the Union. And as a room guide, I was able to pick up a lot of knowledge from other guides who had been volunteering in that capacity for 1, 2, and sometimes 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And so really just by listening, I was able to pick up a lot of knowledge about the general history of Edinburgh and Scotland. And how I came to transition from a volunteer into a job was that certainly the volunteering gave me some great experience and was able to get some excellent references as a result. One of the things that the National Trust for Scotland is very keen on is supporting volunteers. So the people who do get involved with them, you know, have a tendency to want to get even more involved. But it was quite serendipitous, actually, how I began with a job with them. There's a organization at the University of Edinburgh called Freshsight, and they provide consultancy services to charities in Scotland. And I signed up with them just wanting to get a bit more experience on paper. And I found out that one of their clients for that particular semester was the National Trust for Scotland. And I thought, well, that's meant to be. So I applied to be a project manager with them. And this is when the National Trust for Scotland was looking into establishing a student group at the University of Edinburgh and other universities. So I led the charge in finding out whether that was feasible. Are students looking to get engaged with Scottish history? And that was a resounding yes. They absolutely are, which was very encouraging. And from that point, the consultancy process was largely successful. And so I asked, do you need someone to stay on and actually help implement this? And that's how I got involved in a paid position with them. But certainly the volunteering opportunity that I was involved in was crucial in that as well, not only in terms of getting to know people within the National Trust for Scotland, but piquing my interest as well. One of the great things about volunteering, again, whatever the field you're looking to get into, is it's a bit of a proving ground. You find out what you like, what you don't like, what aspects of it you enjoy the most, and so it gives you a clearer idea of what you might want to do. And so it really gave me the confidence to charge ahead and say, you know what, I am quite keen to make a career with an organization like the National Trust for Scotland. And then from there, the Battlemaster job popped up. I noticed that online. And again, reading the title, I thought, there's no way I can pass this up. So applied pronto and was able to get some support from the volunteering department, which was hugely appreciated. And one thing led to another and got the job and haven't looked back since.
So that kind of sounds like you're like the dungeon master in like a D&D game.
You know what? There are comparisons to that. In fact, when people walk into the battle room, we call it, which is great, they almost invariably say, oh man, this is like, Starship Enterprise, because you're in this circular room with a raised observation deck and this glowing table in the middle with the battlefield on it. And we are actually costumed as well.
Oh my gosh,
Go into too much detail about the costume, but I can say that if you've ever played the game Assassin's Creed, it's not too far off from that kind of idea. We've had it described as going into the future to learn about the past. So it's good fun. Myself and the other two battle masters, you can't get us off that battle table. Once we're on it, we just want to keep duking it out in every way that we can. And you do have to put on a persona, and that's great fun because not only is there a real dramatic element to it, but it engages people. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. I mean, you can go to a museum or a standard historical exhibition and read, platforms on walls and do all kinds of, learning that is excellent. It's absolutely essential, but you don't really experience what you're learning about. And the whole idea is it puts you in the hot seat. You are in command of a division of soldiers. And if you don't issue your orders, well, commander, your men are dying. we need action. And so everyone, whether it's 7-year-olds or 70-year-olds, just get so involved in it. And they come out of that room thinking, not only that was fantastic, I want to do it again, but wow, I really feel like I've got an idea of what it was like to be on a medieval battlefield. And I think that kind of learning is not only extraordinarily important for bringing history to life for people, but at this point in time, it's unparalleled. I mean, there's nothing like this experience available anywhere else in the world, as far as we know, where people are able to hop into the shoes of a commander, take part in something this technologically advanced, but at the same time, easy to use. and come out not only having learned a tremendous amount, but having had a lot of fun, too.
It sounds like a ton of fun, and if not if, when we get there next, together or apart, we will definitely have to do that, because that is, I don't care that I'm not male and not 18.
And I'm really bad at strategy games, but I'm totally in. I would totally do it.
We would totally do that.
Well, look forward to seeing you on the battlefield then.
So I'm sure a lot of our listeners would be interested to know how hard it is to move from another country to Scotland and become a member of the area and to get a job and basically become an expat or what would an expat from here.
Yes, and not just the move, but also briefly, how is it because of Canada's membership in the Commonwealth that you were able to make that transition? Or, and especially to get a job, because I could imagine that they would welcome international volunteers. But as far as getting a paid job, we know that as Americans, for example, a non-EU would have a very difficult time getting a job.
Right. And I mean, in terms of the cultural shift, I mean, I'm coming from Eastern Canada, which has a lot of Scottish roots. So it wasn't terribly shocking, but even if you aren't from a place like that, Edinburgh in particular is often described as sort of a collection of villages rather than a large city. And so it's quite easy to settle in and feel welcome and part of a community in Edinburgh. The people overall are very friendly, and there's a large international community here as well. I mean, the University of Edinburgh has almost 30,000 students, so that's a significant chunk of the population of the city. There's about 450,000 people in metropolitan Edinburgh. So right away, you are surrounded by people, even if you're not a student, who are from elsewhere. And the number of times that I've become acquainted with people just by walking down the street and speaking with someone and someone else picking up on my accent and saying, hey, you know, are you from Canada? Oh, I am too. You know, let's hang out. There are, some things to get used to. I mean, the slang can be quite interesting, and the Scots accent is, has various levels of penetrability, I find. The Glasgow accent in particular is particularly well known as being quite dense and hard to wrap your head around. But it's great fun, because the first few days you arrive in a new place, you kind of forget that you've made the move, and you half expect the move rather, and you're expecting to, you know, wake up in your own bed back home in your home country. But then, you know, you hear bagpipes playing outside and you go, something a little different about that. And you walk outside and, you hear the dialect, and it really sort of brings you into where you are. But not in a shocking way, in quite a welcoming way, I find. I was very, very lucky, though, in that being a bit of a mutt myself, I do have German ancestry on my father's side. So I was able to secure a German passport before I came to the UK, which allowed me to stay on indefinitely. I do have several friends where, you know, that's not the case, and they have had a difficult time finding jobs, because you oftentimes have to go to larger organizations in order to get jobs that will give you an extended visa. So it can be a challenge, but that again is where, you know, I would encourage people to get involved with things as soon as possible. So if you were making a move over here and wanted to look at establishing a long-term career, volunteer, because that gets you a foot in the door, and it shows an organization that you're interested and passionate about something. And, one thing really can lead to another. I know quite a few people who come from the States who have been able to stay on precisely because they've gone down that route. My case is quite lucky, because I had that passport to fall back on, but it's certainly it's difficult, but it's not not impossible by any stretch of the imagination.
Excellent. That is good news for many with an EU passport or no. It's good to know that if someone's interested, they can absolutely pursue that.
Yes, definitely. And, even going down the educational route, studying part-time to have a student visa. And so that could be, only 1 or 2 days a week, and you could have a job on the side. And so you'd be able to make a living as well as go down the educational route, and, establish yourself in Scotland. And One of the things I've really realized and come to appreciate since being here is, you know, the greatest things can come from the most inauspicious beginnings. And so I really encourage people to seize opportunities that come along with not only that, but create opportunities as well. Some of the articles that I've had published weren't because I was approached to have them published, for instance. They were because I sent an email with no advance notice, you know, cold calling, as it were, to an editor of a magazine with an idea, and I actually heard back from them, which I wasn't expecting at all, and they said, that sounds interesting, you know, let's put this together. So I would say, if you do come over anywhere, even if, you know, just staying back in the States, wherever you are, go for it. I mean, it's that old Wayne Gretzky quote, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, and you really never know where things can lead you in that sense. I mean, starting with the consultancy firm Freshsight at the University of Edinburgh, I just did that because I thought, I've got not a whole lot on my CV and I need to bulk this up. And then all of a sudden, hey, the National Trust for Scotland is one of our clients. And I became involved with them, and one thing led to another, and now I'm a full-time employee with them. So it certainly can happen.
It's fascinating because we are discussing Scotland right now, but it's also fascinating, an outsider looking in, that while the content of what you say is extremely interesting, the how you got there and your advice and encouragement of others is also fantastic. So thank you so much.
Oh, sure thing. Always glad to share it.
And you actually did our segue very nicely for us. You mentioned the articles. What sort of publications have you had the opportunity to write for?
Yeah, one of the publications that I've been featured semi-regularly in is the Scottish Review. And that's an independent outfit, but it has a circulation of typically between 15 and 20,000 people, mostly in Scotland, but some abroad as well. One of the great things about having a Scottish diaspora is that Scottish content is of interest to people all over the world, whether it's in Canada, the United States, Australia, other areas of Europe. It really has an international scope. And a few of the articles that I've developed for them are on things like, for instance, the last one I did was a little bit off the beaten track from what I normally write about, but it was an article comparing and contrasting the conception of fairies, as in mystical fairies, in Scotland and England, and talking about how the difference in folklore and fairy folklore in Scotland and England reflects different historical experiences. So Scottish fairies and a lot of mythical creatures, things like the Kelpies, which are quite famous in Scotland, they're water horses that have this terrible habit of transforming themselves into humans and going into villages and luring away virginal girls and women, dragging them down to the shores of lochs and rivers and giving them a rather nasty fate. And you usually find a liver or something like that washed up on shore after these people are dragged away. The Scottish folklore does tend to be a bit nasty like that. The fairies steal children. They kill people. They get people lost in the dark. There are trolls that descend from the hills and fling stones into homesteads. And English fairies, on the other hand, you know, tend to be, you know, up to a good bit of mischief, too. Don't get me wrong. But it tends to be fairly limited to mischief. And so I was looking at, you know, why is that? Maybe is it something to do with the comparative ruggedness of the Scottish landscape versus the English landscape? Don't get me wrong. You know, it's hard going in a lot of areas of England as well. So it was interesting to go down a bit more of a mythological route rather than a purely nonfiction route, because the other articles I've developed for them, one is on the Battle of Brunanburh, which was a battle fought in the year 937 AD, before there was truly an England and just after the Kingdom of Scotland was established. And it was described as the biggest, bloodiest battle to date at that point in British history. In fact, people just called it the Great Battle at that point. And again, this is where my interest in things that are off the beaten trail come into play, because you think of a battle in Britain and you think, okay, well, it's probably the English versus the Scots, or and maybe there's a few Welsh in there or something like that. But this was a battle that involved all kinds of Germanic tribes, Angles, Northumbrians. It involved the emerging Kingdom of Scots, but also Vikings who had colonized huge areas on the west coast of Scotland. Lots of the isles were under the control of the Scandinavians until the late 13th century. And you had people from Ireland participating in this. In fact, you had warriors of at least 8 different nations fighting in this battle over 1,000 years ago. And so I was looking at this forgotten battle, really, because almost no one has heard of Brunanburh, even though its significance in the development of British history is arguably up there with a battle like Hastings of 1066, which, you know, just about every British schoolchild has heard of. So I was fighting the good fight on the part of the obscurity of the Battle of Brunanburh in that case. Some of the other articles that I've developed and have in development up to this point are, for instance, one that I'm working on just now for the Scots magazine, which is on my role as battlemaster and a little bit about Scottish castles as well. So it's here and there with a few different publications. The Scottish Review is one of them, you know, looking into the Scots magazine and a few different travel websites as well, like GoNomad.com. And as well, I've also founded a postgraduate journal of the social sciences at the University of Edinburgh. So I was quite involved in that. And that was more on the political side of things, not so much the historical side of things, although you know, history is politics. There's this great quote by a scholar at York University in Toronto, where I did my undergraduate degree, that says, "Theory is always for someone and for some purpose." And that can very easily be flipped around to say history is always for someone and for some purpose. If you don't mind my going off on a little bit of a tangent, absolutely perfect example of that is the emergence of the first Scot in written history. He's a man called Calgacus, and that simply translates to the swordsman. And he pops up in a book by Tacitus, the Roman historian and scholar. It's called The Agricola, and it's about the Roman invasions of Britain, particularly under the command of Gaius Julius Agricola in the late 1st century AD. And Calgacus is presented as chief among chiefs at this battle that was fought between the people who were living in the area that would become known as Scotland and the Romans. At the time, they were known as the Caledonians, and slightly later as the Picts as well. And Picts just means painted people. Painted people, it's a bit of a derogatory term developed by the Romans, because up until about the 3rd century AD, the peoples of northern Britain covered themselves in blue body paint, essentially, to charge into battle. It was extraordinarily intimidating. And so the Romans, who were used to much more civilized warfare, had to go up against this, and it shook them to the core, to the point where the name that they developed for these people became the name that they were known as. And so you have a battle occurring in the year 83 AD called the Battle of Mons Graupius. And it was between about 20,000 Roman legionaries and upwards of 30,000 native peoples of Caledonia, which again is just one of the old words for Scotland. The problem is that Calgacus probably never existed. He was created by Tacitus as a very convenient device, not only to give Gaius Julius Agricola, who was Tacitus's stepfather, a worthy adversary, because most of the chieftains of Caledonia at the time were, for the purposes of history at least, nameless. So he needed a good antagonist to go up against for his stepfather. But Tacitus also had a grudge against the Roman Empire at the time, because he saw it as corrupt, becoming increasingly barbarized and scandalous. And so he painted this picture of Calgacus as this noble warrior, and of the people of Caledonia as what he called the last of the free. And that's a sentiment that would echo down for hundreds and hundreds of years in Scottish history, right up to the modern day, this theme of freedom, which emerged especially in the Scottish Wars of Independence. So you have a case of the first Scot recorded in history actually not existing and functioning as a propaganda device developed by a Roman scholar. I mean, Calgacus apparently said these great words about the Roman Empire, which was, "They create a desert and call it peace, essentially they burn everything in their wake, and then they say, well, we've tamed them, and we've brought civilization to them. And that's a theme that has come up even as recently as the modern wars in the Middle East, that theme. It's an anti-imperialist theme, and it's one that the Caledonians themselves probably weren't aware of, but which Tacitus certainly was. And so history is absolutely for someone and for some purpose. And Scottish history in particular has this habit of being appropriated and viewed from the outside, and then having that view being presented as, you know, the fact. So it's an extraordinarily problematic thing for the historian to look back and think, well, you know, what actually happened? What was really going on? Is this someone's interpretation, or can we take this at face value? So, yeah, that is a side story, if you will, about Scotland's historiography.
First, thank you for sharing that, but you're absolutely right. The history, no matter where it's about, and anything you read that purports to be history, you have to look at who was writing it or who was saying it, and also what their role in it was, if they had one, and what their purpose for producing that is. So, absolutely. That was fascinating.
it's absolutely essential for anything, for any intellectual exercise, you know, to be critical of it.
Yeah.
You know, anything you read, be critical of it. That's the key.
Now, speaking of reading, how did you first become aware of, or when did you first hear about Outlander?
Because we know you just started reading the book.
Yes, but that's later. I want to ask him about how he found out about Scotland first.
Well, you say I've
Scotland? Outlander.
I'm just pointing out that he's not... He found out about the book later. Like, he's obviously found out about the series before he found out about the book.
Yes, so but I want him. That's what I'm saying. Let him tell us that.
Do it.
Yeah, did things slightly in reverse.
Yes, you did.
The series, and what I know is a minor sacrilege in its own right.
No, it was perfect. The way it happened was it was meant to be. That's great.
Let's go with that. You know, it was fate. And you say, you know, I've just started reading the book, but I've only had it for 5 days now, and this version of the book that I have is 863 pages long. I'm currently on page 469.
Ooh, you're
well
fast. Good read.
So,
okay. So but step back before you're right, you just got the book, but tell us, step back, before we ever met virtually, how did you first hear about, or what was your first experience in hearing about the series in Scotland?
Right. Well, funny enough, one of the guys I work with at the Bannockburn Heritage Center is an extra on the Outlander set.
Poor him.
Oh, I know. Must be terrible. And so, you know, we were chatting about some of his experience because he's done quite a bit of work in film and television. And he told me about this new series that was being filmed in Scotland that he was taking part in, and it sounded quite interesting. It was a historical series, so immediately it caught my attention. So I came home that night and did a little bit of searching, and in fact, before I came upon much else, I came upon you guys and found out for the Outlander podcast.
I don't know whether that's
terrifying.
Good or bad. That's very scary.
You guys are front and center.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm glad we didn't scare you away from learning more about the series.
No
kidding. That's a little bit shocking.
And so I recall that, you know, I this tweet to you just saying, you know, well, you know, if Outlander were to need a historical consultant, maybe nudge. At the time, I thought that, you know, I was sending it to the official site, but then, you know, I found out that wasn't the case. But hey, great, you know, that's absolutely fine. And so, you know, we got chatting, and I, you know, found out a little bit more about the series itself, and it seemed like something that would be great to be involved in. I'm always a fan of being involved in something that's alive and in development. It's extraordinarily exciting to be a part of something like that rather than looking at something retrospectively. So, you know, I had this idea to write an article about the history of some of the filming locations that Outlander will be using, and absolutely, you know, excited that you guys have you know, taken that on, and it was great fun to research. So it took me a while to get my hands on the itself, but finally did it, and now I'm you know, plunging ahead post haste.
We will go ahead and put, we're not doing a read along with you right at this moment, we know, but I know you've told us approximately you're about halfway through ish could you, potential spoiler alert, I'll give a little bit of a silence, I just want to know, could you tell us approximately where you are? something that has happened.
Right. I am at the return to Castle Leoch after the trip around parts of the Highlands to gather resources for the budding Jacobite cause that the Mackenzie seem to be embroiled in, or at least some of the Mackenzies to date.
What chapter are you on?
I am on...
I don't want to spoil you.
I'm on chapter 24 by the pricking of...
Okay. Wow, you're actually ahead of our read-along.
Perhaps I shouldn't give up too much at this point, but one of the things I'm actually able to relate with quite well is what it's like to be at a standing stone circle. Because I had the pleasure of going up to the Orkney Islands this past summer, which
again,
was...
Poor you.
It was a trial, I tell you.
It was! I can't believe you survived and you're telling us about it.
It's a place where the magic really is tangible in the air. And I went to a place on the Orkney mainland, that's what they call the largest of the Orkney Islands, which is the heart of Neolithic Orkney, and it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And there are several amazing places there, foremost of which, in my opinion, is the Ring of Brodgar, which is a 4,500-year-old standing stone circle. And it's got... still standing upwards of 20 massive stones. Some of them are very curiously shaped. There's one that I think is very deliberately shaped like a human head, in fact, which is, you know, entrancing, but also a little bit creepy in the light of the setting sun, where it's silhouetted against this orange sky. And in the center of this massive ring, which is easily 75 paces across, you know, in diameter, is this flourishing patch of bright purple heather, which is this lichen which grows in many parts of the Highlands and islands. And I visited in late August when it was at its height. So it was bright purple. Not only that, but the Ring of Brodgar is in a network of Neolithic sites, Neolithic just being the new Stone Age, so the period of approximately 5000 BC up until the beginning of the Bronze Age, which in Scotland's case at least occurred around 1500 BC. So going back in time to an extent that's almost unfathomable, you know, the amount of time that passed between when these stones were put up and the present day, it is mind-boggling. I mean, more time elapsed between when this standing stone circle was raised and the construction of the Great Pyramids in Egypt than has elapsed between the construction of the Great Pyramids in Egypt and this moment right now. So that puts it in perspective a little bit. And I tend to not be a spiritual sort myself, but I can say that standing in the center of this stone circle and approaching one of these rocks, and very much like Claire did, in fact, you know, putting her hand on one, I almost wanted to start a little fire and get some buddies and, you know, dance around the circle into the night and go pagan. Because it really did feel like, you know, communing with a time that has passed long, long ago, but which there are still monuments of, you know, even in the modern day. And as I say, it's part of a much larger network of locations as well. I mean, within sight of the Ring of Brodgar, you have Maze Howe, which is a chambered area, which is under this hill, this grassy mound. And that goes back several thousand years as well. And it's a very mysterious place. They don't know exactly what it was constructed for, which lends to the atmosphere there, but it's got the largest collection of Viking runic inscriptions anywhere outside of Scandinavia, inside of this chambered area called Maze Howe. And so you realize, putting the pieces together, Ring of Brodgar over here, Maze Howe over there, you know, other standing stone circles within sight, how important things like this would have been to people thousands of years ago. The amount of effort that communities would have put in to raising these ceremonial sites, the kinds of things that would have occurred there. Everything from ritualistic sacrifices to communal feasts, marriages. In fact, there's a stone still standing there which has a hole in the middle of it, and it said that it was an Orcadian tradition for lovers to hold hands, you know, going through the hole in the stone and to make a vow, and that that vow was one that was to the old gods, even well over 1500 years after most of Scotland came into the fold of Christendom. And so you have a place where people are still very much in touch with their ancient roots, which is an absolute delight to go and experience. And so I can relate to Claire in a sense of getting this just baffling feeling. I didn't have stones, you know, shouting at me, but, you know, they definitely do speak to you, for lack of a better phrase.
That I've only actually had the chance, the great fortune, but I've only actually had the chance to see the clavicern. Now, those are the only stones that I've physically, personally been to. That was because they were close to where I was visiting.
Right.
You did mention a few things about their ancient uses, but I think the fascinating thing about, one of the most fascinating things about any of these stones is that, or whether they're rings or not, is that we know so very little about them and they're what they were used for, mm-hmm. that the great mystery around them. But the proof of their importance is, as you said, the fact that the sheer effort alone that it took to raise them and to bring them from wherever they are from shows that for people without modern technological and transportation conveniences, this was a massive undertaking.
It would have been. It would have involved entire communities or even, you know, sets of communities. And one of the important things to remember about places like this, the same goes for, you know, the world famous Stonehenge, is that they weren't put up all at once. They were developed over hundreds of years. So oftentimes a stone circle starts as just a henge, and a henge is an area that is enclosed by a shallow ditch. And more often than not, historians think that it would have been simply a gathering site that was in view of the gods, a place of importance. This is, again, going back to a time where, you know, it's tribalistic. So you have a sense of connection with the landscape, which I think we very much lost in modern society, and also a sense of, you know, survivalism. This was a dog-eat-dog world to a great extent. The symbolic importance of having your neighbors helping you to put up this massive ceremonial ground in over the course of hundreds of years, it's a bonding exercise. It's something that brought disparate peoples together. And these people, you know, got around more than we give them credit. We often think that they live very much like folks in very, very rural areas do now. You know, oftentimes you don't leave the place that you were born all your life. And if you do, it's to the next village over. One of the fascinating things about ancient Scotland is that before there were roads, highways, modern forms of transportation of any means, it was the seaways that were the highways. And you have cases of people traveling hundreds of miles over the course of just several days up and down the west coast of Scotland, in and out of the lochs that dot it. And even the Scots themselves were a tribe that originally came from Ulster in Northern Ireland. And over several hundred years, they migrated across the Irish Sea to the west coast of Scotland, to the area mostly around the Mull of Kintyre, the Isle of Arran, and the Firth of Clyde. And so you have the case of people coming from hundreds of miles all around and using materials from hundreds of miles away as well. Lots of the stones that are found in standing stone circles don't come from the local area. They're brought from dozens, if not hundreds of miles away, which is startling, not only in the amount of effort that it would take to construct them, but also in, again, the symbolic value of that. If you went out of your way to a very remote location to get the finest stone or a particular kind of stone, oftentimes it was stone that was up on a very high point. Again, this idea of being close to the gods and having to overcome a challenge in order to really imbue worth into something. It really starts to paint a picture of people who were incredibly invested in not just their spirituality, but in their community and what they felt they had to do to live in harmony, not just with their environment, but with each other. So they're fascinating in terms of sociological and anthropological monuments, not just as historical monuments.
Excellent. The whole phenomenon and the whole subject of standing stones is, I've always found, exceedingly interesting. Maybe one day we will know, we'll probably never know everything about them, but maybe one day we will know much more about them. But I will certainly likely not be on this earth when that is the case. So any conversation about them, I am very willing to listen to. I find them fascinating.
Well, you never know what might happen. I mean, Richard III just got dug up from underneath a parking lot.
Right. Well, now you go and bring up that near the end. Oh my goodness. No, seriously, you're absolutely right, especially in Europe where civilization has been for thousands of years and not just been localized, but also built a society or culture upon culture upon culture, literally as they build up. One generation after generation, they build on top of each other. And what excavations will find is, it always promises to be fascinating.
It really does. I think archaeology is going to have a boon over the next little while, because it was only back in the late 1970s that it was made mandatory here for archaeologists to be on site during any kind of significant development. So, I mean, when you think about all the things that might have been lost, prior to that. But also with things being refurbished, with buildings being torn down and built up anew, and with that policy in place of an archaeologist consultant having to be present, you really never know what they might dig up, just down the road.
Excellent. Well, and if anything does, we will certainly have you back, because that is something that we would love someone to discuss that with if something pops up in the news again.
Well, I've got my ear to the ground for it, so I'm more than happy.
We will rely on you for that then.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Dave, so much for joining us. We look forward to having you on in the future, since you're basically almost done with the book. We look forward to having you join us for a read-along in the not-too-distant future, and we will definitely be in touch about that. Thank you for sharing so much about your experience and your job and telling us what you were able to tell us. And listeners, you will be able to find his article that he shared with us about Castle Dune and the village of Kolross on our blog.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks very much. And I will have to take a look at some reading notes for Outlander, which, funny enough, is actually, it's called Cross Stitch on this side of the pond.
Yes, that's it right. Is.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Which is probably why you had a hard time finding it.
It may have had something to do with it.
Well, that's true. And also, there is, from what I understand, it's either a scene or a chapter. I think it's just a scene, but there is something, we will not spoil it for you. You can find it when you come along, when you're able to find the book Outlander versus Cross-Stitch.
Okay.
But there is one scene that was deemed potentially not fit or not fit for the UK or for British sensibilities.
Ah.
And it involves something called waterweed. If you Google that, I promise you.
They cut that out.
They cut out waterweed. If you Google it, you will know. I'm going to keep it at that because it's a little more, summer. You can find out all about the waterweed.
You can Google
okay.
that. You'll find it. Google Outlander waterweed.
Yes.
That's my next point of research.
There you go.
And I sure hope that we aren't the first thing that comes up under that.
I hope not. Well, thank you again so much, Dave, for spending some of your time with us. We know it's quite late where you are, and you are out today busy visiting more castles.
Yeah, well, I've got a trip to Aberdeenshire next weekend, so I'll actually be visiting Castle Fraser. That will certainly have some relevance. I'll perhaps send along some notes of discovery from after my visit.
Oh, my God.
Pictures.
Yeah. Pictures, if you can.
Oh, yes.
And also, well, if we plan a read-along in the next month or month and a half, whenever that happens, But we would love to have you on here to discuss that for a few minutes anyway.
I'd be delighted to.
Great. Well, thank you so much and have a great evening.
And you. Thanks very much, Summer Ginger. All the best to you.
Okay, you too as well.
Take care. Bye.
You
bye.
Too. Bye-bye.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
Last night that my young